take a middle path between the observational sort of talks, of which you just heard a very nice summary by Ariel, and the very theoretical talks about the fundamental physics. So as the title of the workshop says, Cosmological Frontiers and Fundamental Physics. So I'm going to try to bring both ends together in this way. And specifically being talking about various models for the dark energy and how the observations can elucidate what the fundamental physics is. So the first point I want to make is that when you think of acceleration in the universe, you, of course, have the early stage of inflation in the very earliest universe and the current stage today. And one might want to tie them together in thought, if not in actual practice. But really, they're very different. They have very different characteristics. And I'll even be so bold as to say that dark energy is probably the harder problem. And the reasons for this are two that I put up there. Dark energy is, we believe, not eternally in a slow roll, that there are instances where the slow roll breaks down. That may be true for inflation as well. And what we know for sure is that dark energy does not completely dominate the universe today. There is a matter component to the universe that's substantial today. And so that makes things altogether more difficult. I'll be getting to that in later slides. So what this leads to is what's sometimes called fine-tuning problems, coincidence problems, or here I've phrased it as the Goldilocks problem, that you don't want to be too far to either end of the spectrum. You don't want your porridge too hot or too cold. You want it just right. So we want a universe that is somehow just what we observe. And that's quite a hard problem to do. So for dark energy, it clearly must be dynamically important. We do observe the acceleration of the expansion today. But as I say, it's not fully dominant. There is somewhere between a quarter and a third of the energy density budget of the universe in non-relativistic matter. And so we want to somehow get a number that's of order one, but not exactly one. It's accelerating, and in fact, the equation of state, the pressure to density ratio, is fairly strongly negative. It's not just close to the acceleration boundary, but it's fairly close to the cosmological constant boundary, and Ariel showed you a number of the most recent data for that. But if we try to make it either exactly a cosmological constant or to bring this equation of state parameter close to minus one, then we run into these fine-tuning problems. And one way to get around those fine-tuning problems are to have attractor solutions. And generically, those need a certain period of fast roll to get you on to the attractor trajectories. So it's not a completely general statement, but in general, somewhere along the line, you may well violate slow roll when talking about dark energy. And then, of course, the big question is it just a lambda or is it something else? If it's not a lambda, what happened to lambda? And how do you get it to be something other than a lambda? If it is lambda, how do you get it to be lambda? So it's questions all the way down, really, in trying to address these problems. And I'll talk about some of the mostly phenomenological ways that we have of addressing these so far. So first, I want to give you a history of the universe and dark energy and why it's so exciting in one slide. So if you go back to the golden ages of classical cosmology, so call it the 1930s through the 1970s, when we asked what was the expansion of the universe like, so the scale factor of the universe A as a function of time, we're sitting here at time zero, scale factor one, we look back into the past. Presumably there was a Big Bang state, you go 30s through the 70s, you of course have to include, I certainly can't see it from down here, I don't know if you can, this curve one, this green dotted curve of a bounce universe. And there was a wide variety of different possible universes one could have. Open universes, closed universes, critical universes, loitering universes, and so forth. So that was sort of a 1930s to 1970s history of cosmology. As we had better data, better technology, better telescopes, we could zoom in on a particular region and look at it in much more detail. And so as we move into, let's call it the 1980s to 1990s, we have this finer picture of the universe. Again, we're sitting here looking back into the past. And we thought it could well be an Einstein de Sitter universe, a flat critical density universe with everything in omega matter in a non-relativistic component today, basically. Or it could be somewhere toward an empty universe where there's nothing, that is, where you have some curvature density as well. And of course, we knew about possibilities such as the cosmological constant, the Sitter universes, and so forth. But we were pretty sure it lay somewhere between this blue curve and this purple curve. And of course, the great excitement in 1998 was when the two groups announced that, in fact, that was completely wrong. It lay over on the other side, somewhere near this black curve, where you have both some matter and some cosmological constant roughly midway in between the two extremes. And in particular, it was an accelerating universe. And so that's a sort of the current stage that we're at. We think it's somewhere near that black solid curve. What we'd like to do in the next step is to zoom in again, but a very ambitious zoom. So instead of zooming into that large rectangle from before, we want to zoom into that narrow triangle there. And we want to really find out only sort of the width of that curve, what are the subtle variations in the expansion history. And if we're able to do that, then we're going to learn an awful lot about what dark energy is. And so the goal is given by this red shaded curve, which are the 95% confidence level contours for SNAP, the supernova acceleration probe that Ariel mentioned. And if we can do that, and here I've centered it on a omega matter of 0.3 plus a cosmological constant bringing you up to a flat universe model, then we can start to see the difference between different models. For example, models where you've changed the nature of the vacuum, where you've changed the nature of gravity or the number of dimensions. And once we can zoom in on that level, then we can start to answer some important questions. Are we talking about new quantum physics responsible for the acceleration, the nature of the vacuum, which here I've given the more memorable phrase of does nothing weigh something, or do we need to change the nature of our gravitational theory, perhaps go to extra dimensions, which I've phrased as is nowhere somewhere. And so those are the two very paradoxical questions that we'd like to be able to address with the next generation of data. So what we could do is go model by model. You sit down every theorist and restrict them to, say, thinking of 10 models of the universe, plot all those curves and compare it against the data, and one by one cross off some models and say other models are possible. So that's a bit exhausting to do. So what you'd like to do is maybe start from the data and let the data reconstruct for you what is your theory. For example, what is the scalar field potential, if that's what you're talking about. So that's a goal, but unfortunately it's not a goal that is realizable. So here I've written down formally what you can do with that goal. If you measure the expansion history, you can get the equivalent equation of state, pressure to density ratio, W of Z. I'll be talking about W of Z an awful lot in this talk. And given a W of Z formally, you can reconstruct the density, you can reconstruct the field, the potential of the field, the kinetic energy of the field, and so on and so forth. But in reality, it does you very little good. And you can see why by looking at this last equation here, for how the field moves, the kinetic energy. Let's look how much will that field roll over the period of our observations. So it's proportional to the square root of this quantity. And the energy density today is, the square root of it is roughly the Hubble parameter, and I've written back in the G's or the M Planck's for those of you who like it that way. But you have this factor out front. And so if you're close to the cosmological constant, if W is close to -1, then in fact the field does not roll very far over the time that we can observe it. And so the amount that the field rolls is much, much smaller than a Planck energy. And so that makes it extremely hard to reconstruct the potential because you're only seeing a very tiny piece of the potential. So you really don't know what the underlying theory is. And so if I've said, well, the model by model way of going about things is a bit impractical and the direct reconstruction way is a bit impractical, what does that leave us? And the first thing that we can try is phenomenology. Try parameterizing the dark energy in some way and then comparing that against the observations or comparing that against the theory. And so the dark energy equation of state is a phenomenological parameter that we can deal with. We can say, let's fit the equation of state and then compare that fit to the data, compare that fit to various theories. How well do we want to come up with this function of this dark energy equation of state, this W of Z? To learn the physics, to learn the dynamics of what's going on, you could say, well, I need at least two parameters. So again, in terms of inflationary language, lingo, I can call it a tilt. How far is the equation of state from a cosmological constant value? How far is 1 plus w from 0? And what's the running? How does that change with time or with scale factor, for example? And so that's really what I think is the minimum to learn the physics. It's natural to ask, well, okay, if that's the minimum, what's the maximum? How well can we actually do? How many parameters could we fit? And would they actually teach us anything if so? So to ask how well you can fit something, you need some sort of criterion for success. So I've written up here a fairly arbitrary criterion saying, I want to know things at sort of the 10 to 20% level. I want to know, is it the cosmological constant to about 10%? I want the value to within about 10%. And I want to know its running, its dynamics, to about 20% in units of the Hubble time. And I'll give you the short answer now that the next generation data, if you launch the Joint Dark Energy Mission, you've got next generation supernova data, you've got next generation weak lensing data, you launch the Planck satellite, you have next generation CMB data, your minimum is your maximum. You're going to get two parameters out at this criterion of signal to noise that I have here. That's not bad. We reached our minimum, okay? So we've got some success. You might say, oh, well, I wanted 10 parameters, you know, even if you're not quite sure what you do with 10 parameters. But we're going to have two, and I'm going to argue that two is going to tell us an awful lot. But first, let me justify a little bit why I say we only have two. First of all, let me define this running a bit more formally. Again, in analogy to inflation, it's basically an e-fold derivative, the change in W with respect to the logarithm of the scale factor. And in a fairly common parametrization for W of A, my two-parameter parametrization here running with scale factor, it's simply equal to minus WA over 2. So sometimes I'll talk about W prime, sometimes I'll talk about WA, same thing. So let me justify a little bit why only two parameters. You can justify this in a number of ways. You can try inventing four-parameter models and seeing how well you can simulate the fit of next-generation data. We've done that with quite a number of different parametrizations. A more model-independent way is to use principal component analysis. And so this was done in a paper with Drug and Hutterer. And for the details, you should see that paper. But here I've basically plotted the inverse signal to noise. So the lower this is, the better, the higher the signal to noise there is. For different combinations of next generation data. And by next generation, I don't mean what Ariel was talking about, you've got the supernova legacy survey finished. I mean, you launch the satellites, you get, you know, the best data you're going to get in the next 15 years or so. And so what the principal components say is when you add everything together, supernova, weak lensing, and CMB, you get two components at a really good signal to noise. A signal to noise is about 30 or so. Then you get another two to three components at signal to noises of 3 to 5, which doesn't meet my success criterion. Okay, you might have a lower success criterion and you could say, okay, we can fit 5 parameters. But that's where I get the number 2 from. So we're gonna get the tilt and we're gonna get the running with the next generation, and we're going to get indications of other parameters. And those indications are useful to test for things like bias. As Ariel spoke about, when you parameterize in a certain way, you always want to check that you're not biasing your results, you're not prejudicing them in a certain direction. Or things like if you wanted to test if there's a very rapid transition, then you can use these lower signal-to-noise parameters to help test for that. But again, I don't think we should be depressed about this. I think we should be happy that we met our minimum, that to learn the physics, we've in fact are able to fit these two parameters very well. Suppose you want to take those two parameters, and now you want to say, okay, where do I learn the physics from? So I've got my W prime. How do I understand physics? How do I take this whole variety of theory models that I can get from different gravity theories, different string theories? How do I learn what the physics is? So in work I did with Rob Caldwell, we asked that question. We tried to be as general as possible. And I'm going to start off talking in terms of a scalar field and then generalize from there. So here you've got the Klein-Gordon equation. How does the scalar field move? What's its dynamics? And you see that it's got two very general properties. It's driven by the steepness of the potential, and it's slowed down by a Hubble expansion, a Hubble friction term. And so you think, let me try to characterize it as to which one wins out in which time epoch of the universe. So maybe the field was rolling initially, and then it's decelerated by this Hubble drag, or maybe it was frozen by the Hubble drag, and then it was released to roll when it dominated the universe. And so we call those two possibilities freezers and thawers. And we asked, OK, let's just start trying a bunch of scalar field models and ask, are they freezers or thaws? Can you confuse a freezer with a thaw? You know, how does the phase space look when you go in these parameters? And we found a very interesting result that not only can you characterize these fields in these two different ways, but they're very distinct ways. You really split the phase space very distinctly into these two categories. So you've got these thawing fields. They start off as a cosmological constant. They start off frozen, and they move out to more positive W's, and they gain a dynamics. You have freezing fields that started off rolling, and now they're starting to freeze. They're starting to move in toward a cosmological constant. And I'll show you some specific curves in a moment. We tried these for quite a few different potentials. And as I say, in a few slides, I'll generalize it beyond the scalar field theory. Again, the details are in the PhysRev letter. So there are two very important lessons to take away from this. Number one is, if you are talking about current generation experiments, so the supernova legacy survey, the weak lensing surveys going on now, all the ones that are best and brightest hopes for the next 5 years, they're not going to tell us the physics. This entire upper half plane, any point in this thawing region, will look just like a cosmological constant, to 5%. This next generation of experiments cannot do a constant W, which is what they're trying to do. They cannot do those to 5%. We're not going to get an answer as to whether something's a cosmological constant or not. If we see something that looks like a cosmological constant, maybe it is, maybe it's a thawing field. All we would have done is ruled out half of the plane, if we can reach that limit. The second important point is that you do have this gap. You do have this distinction between these two different fields. And that gives you a measure now in the space. How well do I need to make my experiment to be able to see the difference between a freezing field and a thawing field? So the precision you need to measure the dynamics with is of order twice the tilt. And so that was one very important result that I think needs to be used for these next generation of experiments in saying, how well should a satellite experiment actually do? So these are some curves in the actual phase plane. So these are linear, quadratic, and quartic potentials up here. Pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone boson models also live up here. Down here live tracker models, inverse power laws, Suger-inspired models, and so forth. So a Suger-inspired model, it starts off tracking, so along the W prime equals zero line. It curves along, stays within this freezing region, and eventually in the far future moves to a cosmological constant. These thawing models, as I say, quartic, quadratic, pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone, start off frozen as a cosmological constant. They're moving away. But because we have those observational constraints that we haven't fully dominated the universe by dark energy and that the equation of state is somewhere near minus one, we've restricted ourselves to these yellow shaded regions here. You can, yes. No, so that's a different case where you're changing the nature of the kinetic energy. And a number of people are just starting to look at it. So there was a paper by Chiba that just came out, and Bob Scherer is looking at that as well. And so it'll be interesting. The preliminary indications are they actually do fall within this freezing region. So you can say, okay, we have this WW prime, this phenomenology. We've tied it to the fundamental physics by specific potentials. But again, what's the general nature of this? Where do these regions arise from? Why do you have these restricted regions? And so this is a second paper that Rob Caldwell and I are working on, where we ask, what's the physical reason why you have these restricted regions? And basically, it has to do, again, with these ratios of the friction term to the steepness term. For example, this upper line, this upper boundary in the thawing region, has to do with the fact that if you take a frozen field in a matter-dominated universe, as it starts to thaw from that frozen field, it must start off moving along that particular line. And so it starts moving along there, and then it'll start to curve off from there. This bottom curve, again, you can put some physical reasoning behind it. The middle curves are a bit more phenomenological, again, having to do with that omega dark energy is 0.7 today, as opposed to 1 or as opposed to 0.1. And again, there's this null line corresponding to where the potential is flat, where you've hit a minimum. A cosmological constant is one example of a flat potential. But you could also have what are called skating models, and I know Andrew's written about this as well, where you have a flat potential, but the field has some velocity along that potential. Those will move along this, what I call this null line here. You can also talk, instead of the field variables, you can talk in terms of an energy. So here I've defined an energy scale, which is basically just V over V prime. And you can ask, what do the curves of different energy look like? So I've plotted them up here. And in particular, when V prime is zero, you have that null line here. Here if I've extended it out all the way from W minus one to W plus one. And a very interesting point is, suppose I put a physical constraint and I say, I don't want to look at any models with... previous one? Okay.
Right. If you go away from scalar field modeling of this dark energy, do you still get the gap between the freezing and thawing, what you call freezing and thawing?
Right. So I've got it. Once I finish with the scalar fields, I move on to some modified gravity models, and I'll get to that question. But the short answer is I don't know yet. So if we define this an energy scale, suppose we want to say, I don't want to have anything to do with any fields with an energy scale greater than M Planck, that I'm scared of them, I just don't know how to deal with them. What that does is it then constrains your parameter space. And so what I'm going to do is I'm now going to zero in on this tiny little region right near the cosmological constant and see what saying I don't want to have anything to do with trans-Planckian physics will do. So if I do that, so here's my null line here. Here's my curve that divides the region where this energy parameter is less than M Planck from greater than M Planck. And then here in these green lines, this was my thawing region. And of course, my freezing region lies down here completely within E greater than M Planck. But if I have some physical reason for thinking that my energy scale must be less than M Planck, then what you see is I exclude this region near the cosmological constant because of this little hump that comes up here. So if I do that, and again, I don't know of any particular reason why I should do that, but if I do that, then I say that my scalar fields must lie out here. So for the first time, I have some reason for putting a barrier around lambda. Normally you say I can populate my phase space, I can make any scalar field look infinitely close to lambda. But if I can have some reason to constrain the energy scale, then I don't do that. My field can run in, but I can never get closer to lambda than that. And so for the first time, I can put a measure in the space, and I can say, how precise does my experiment need to do to tell the difference between an arbitrary scalar field and a lambda? And of course, maybe there's nothing magical about the energy scale being less than M Planck. Maybe it should be less than the string scale. Maybe it should be M Planck over 2 pi. I mean, you'll have to tell me what the correct answer should be. But of course, if it's over 2 pi, this hump comes up even more, and your barrier moves out even further, and you have even more of a distance between the cosmological constant and your scale, which makes the next generation experiments easier. So we don't think next generation experiments are going to get down to a precision of 0.005, but if the barrier moves out, then we've got a better shot. Yes?
Why do you call this minus V over V prime energy? In what sense is it energy?
It has the units of energy. That's all.
But so V has also the units of...
That's right.
So why do you choose this instead of some other combination?
So when you look at... So you could either talk about it in terms of the Klein-Gordon equation or the equation relating W prime, W, and this combination of parameters. That's the combination that enters into this phase space, this W prime phase space. If there's a justification for using some other combination, we can plot on the scale what that combination will look like.
As
I say, I have no justification for this constraint. I'm hoping that someone will tell me from gravity or from string theory if there is a justification.
And I just wanted to comment, obviously, if you impose that constraint, you don't allow any potential to have a minimum.
Because then
it'll be infinite, that is going to be inconsistent with a lot of ideas from particle physics, like Higgs breaking, et cetera, et cetera.
So right.
I'm sure there is no generic rule that's going to justify
right.
that.
Right, but then you run into fine-tuning problems as well, that why should we be sitting at the minimum now? Okay.
Sure.
We know we weren't sitting at the minimum a long time ago, unless it was a cosmological constant. And why didn't it take us till the future? So, yeah, there's a lot of gray areas here.
Yeah, Eric?
Yeah.
I was wondering, why does constraining yourself to energies below M Planck give you that small hump there? I can sort of see that for the freezing field, but if you assume you have a cosmological constant, a scalar field with a completely flat potential, you tilt it just a little bit, then you should in principle be still in a valid region. There is no need to consider energy density larger than M Planck, right?
No, if you tilt it, a tilt is specifically a V over V prime, right?
Sorry, so E is a... I withdraw my question.
Okay, so as a few people have mentioned, you know, they're a little impatient with me sticking to scalar fields and canonical scalar fields at that. So I've ignored the whole half of the plane that lies past minus one. Was that a legitimate thing to do? So there's considerable debate about this about these phantom fields. In particular, they generically have ghosts, have instabilities. So a number of people have realized that it's perfectly possible to talk about effective equations of state more negative than minus one, effectively phantom fields, that don't have bad physics. And I'll take a quote here from the 1984 movie Ghostbusters, when one of the characters is asked, well, what do you mean by bad? They respond with this quote. And it's interesting that quote is almost exactly a description of what happens in a big rip scenario with phantom energy in the universe. Anyway, here are five solutions, and they're not unique. There are many other solutions, I'm sure, out there in the literature for how you can have phantoms without ghosts. And here are the references. You can go through them in more detail if you like. So I don't think we should ignore that left half of the plane with W more negative than minus one. All right, that's still scalar fields pretty much. What about modified gravity? Well, as far as the Friedmann equation goes, we're perfectly safe in admitting our ignorance and saying, well, we know there's matter in the universe and there's something else, and we don't know what that something else is. So we can say that something else is due to a new component, or we can say that it's due to a modification of the Friedmann equation. Regardless, you can still define an effective equation of state that's formally perfectly okay, and that any modification you make to the expansion history, no matter what the origin is, can be talked about as that effective equation of state. Once you have that, you can play all the usual games. You can define an effective potential for that, even though it has nothing to do with the scalar field. You can define an effective kinetic energy and so forth. And here I've given two particular examples. One is where you're taking your Friedmann equation, you take your linear term in rho, and then you add some power in rho, for example. And Katie's worked on models like this. And there you get a very simple answer for what the equation of state is. It's just minus one plus whatever that index is. You can take an arbitrary function of this, which a number of people have looked at. Bob Scherer just had a very nice paper on this. And I've been working with him on extending this a bit. You get an equation of state. You can plot in that same phase space, that W prime W phase space, what happens. And you find it lies right along the bottom of that freezing region, that's that term, plus an extra term depending on that exact function. And so you can violate the bound that we had in the paper with Rob Caldwell. You can go below the bottom of the freezing region, but it turns out you can only do that, you can only make that derivative in there positive, hence making that negative, if you flip over to the phantom end of things. So this is work in progress. Yes? So let me point out, in these models, you don't have dark energy. Everything is rho matter, but you've changed your Friedmann equations, you've changed your gravity equation.
Can you remind me what's the definition of K?
The just 1/2 phi dot squared, so canonical kinetic energy.
Okay, but I mean, you cannot map arbitrary expansion history to a scalar field, because a scalar field will always obey the null energy condition if you have a canonical kinetic term.
So these are not canonical scalar fields, you're right. We're making an effective, we can just formally write it down. We're not saying it means anything. I'm just saying you can still talk about it in terms of an equation of state, and I'm saying that because on the next slide I'm going to say why that's bad. But in some cases, it does make sense. Okay, there are theories, and for example, Katie's theories that are motivated from higher dimension theories. You can look for theoretical motivations for this and then ask, what is the phase diagram? What is the WW prime diagram like? Another modification of gravity you could think of are scalar tensor theories. And in particular, I'll talk about the linear coupling to the Ricci scalar. And there's some interesting properties of those that were pointed out, that they have attractor trajectories, so you can start from a very wide variety of initial conditions. And again, you can write down an effective equation of state and a running, and it turns out that they're basically equivalent to a Jordan Brands-Dickey theory. And what it shows is there's still this relationship between the running and the tilt, that they're still basically linearly proportional to each other. The problem, of course, is that we have very good constraints on Brands-Dickey theories from the solar system. In particular, the Cassini radar ranging shows that's got to be a very large parameter, and hence you've got to be very close to a cosmological constant. But again, I'll throw it out to the audience, either to talk about now or at the panel on Thursday. Is it legitimate to take a solar system constraint done in a Schwarzschild background, where you've got a coupling to the Ricci scalar, and use those constraints in the cosmology, where you've got a very different background? So that's a question that, again, is I think, not well addressed in the literature. And it turns out, if you look at this, it falls in the freezing regime of the phase space diagram. But to give a hint at what I'll show in a few slides, this was the expansion history. In general, these scalar tensor theories have a non-vanishing anisotropic stress term. And so that's going to screw up the development of structure in the universe, or at least change it from the normal Friedman one. And so that gives us another window. As my final example, that's not a scalar field, DGP gravity, brain world gravity, here's the track, the phase space track of DGP gravity as you go from high Z, where it's just frozen at the value minus a half, as you track it down to more recent regions, and it lies within this green region, which is precisely the freezing region. And so we see it acts just like a freezing scalar field in this case. Okay, so as I already hinted at, W of Z is really general. It tells us an awful lot, but it doesn't tell us enough. It doesn't tell us the origin of physics, that many different types of physics can act in the same way. And so we need another handle besides the expansion history, besides measuring distances. And the growth of mass, because it has to do with the gravity theory more directly, is a very good handle on that. So here I've plotted the linear perturbation growth as a function of scale factor. And I've plotted two curves here that overlap each other, the blue and the red. One is the DGP brain world model, where all I do is say the growth only depends on the expansion. I modify the Friedman equation. Let me just plug that into my normal growth equations. And then I've come up with a scalar field model, two parameters, because that's all I get to use from next generation data, which basically exactly overlies it. So a scalar field and DGP gravity are indistinguishable. But what I've done is not legitimate, because you cannot simply take the expansion and put it into the growth. You've changed the gravity theory as well. You've got to take that into account. When you do take it into account, the fact that it has different equations of gravity, then it shifts that red curve, sorry, the blue curve down, and you have now broken the degeneracy between the scalar field model and the brain world model. Of course, I could come up with another scalar field model that does have the degeneracy that will agree on the growth, but then it won't agree on the expansion history. And so if I have those two measurements, then I can break the degeneracy and I can see what the origin of the physics is. So I think it's very important to emphasize you want to measure distances and you want to measure growth of mass in this way. And you can see this is not a trivial difference. That's about 15% in the linear power spectrum, which is well within measurement abilities. So here's basically what I said before, except now I've said it in equations. Here's the linear growth equation with scale factor. The Friedman version, I've generalized it, so instead of setting g Newton equal to 1, I've now set it to be something arbitrary. And instead of the right-hand side being 0, I've said it's some function. You tell me the gravity theory, you can fill in what that should be, and if g is different from g Newton. So again, we can go model by model. Each theorist comes up with a model, we compare it against data, that's perfectly okay. But maybe we want a phenomenological way of doing it. So just like we have a WW prime parameterization, maybe there's a parameterization that tells us something about what the gravity's doing. And so this is what I've developed here. So here's your linear perturbation. The exact solution would come from that equation. This is an approximate solution involving the matter density, how it runs with scale factor. And here's my phenomenological parameter, gamma, a growth index. For a scalar field, you can work out an equation like this, an approximation, but an incredibly good approximation. It holds to the exact solution to about 0.1%. You can ask, how does that work for modified gravity theories? You got to test them one by one. I've only tested it for one, the DGP theory, and it works beautifully. This formula works beautifully with a gamma very different than what you would get from a scalar field. And so what that says is if I can make observations of both expansion and growth, if I make observations of both WW prime and this growth index gamma, then I can get a diagram like this. So I make my measurements and I say, okay, here's my error contour in this plane. If it's general relativity, so this is what I predict for measuring the expansion history. If it's general relativity, then X marks the spot, that should be the answer. I look at my data, I find an answer up there with a very different gamma from what scalar fields would predict, and I'd say, okay, it's not general relativity, it's brain world gravity. And so by expanding the phenomenological parameter space, I can now see the difference between high energy physics of fields and of gravity. That was linear theory. Nonlinear theory is a lot more complicated, but progress has been made there as well. So the fitting functions that people currently use for this are usually good to about 10%, and they're tuned to the lambda CDM model, to the cosmological constant. So Martin White and I looked and said, can we do better than that? Can we fit dark energy models in a very generic way? So we came up with a mapping prescription. And here is a large-scale structure numerical simulations of five different dark energy models, including lambda. And the blue curve is the the Smith-Peacock fitting function. You see they're clearly different. It's known that Smith-Peacock is not a perfect fit. And here's the comparison of these five different models to each other. You see that our mapping prescription gets us not just the linear power spectrum, but the entire nonlinear power spectrum to about 1%. So we've done about an order of magnitude better, and we've made it for any dark energy cosmology. This is one of the ingredients that now needs to be put into all the observational prescriptions, while what weak lensing predict for different dark energies, and so on and so forth. If anyone feels like doing something similar for modified gravity models, please go to it. It looks like a really difficult problem. Oh, and I should mention that our particular prescription means you not only fit large-scale structure, but at the same time, you automatically fit the CMB temperature power spectrum as well. So let me finish up with where I think we will be at the end of the next generation. So Ariel talked about the SNAP satellite, the supernova acceleration probe, which we hope will be launched sometime around 2012, although, you know, fingers are crossed and all. And he showed diagrams such as omega lambda versus omega matter. And of course, you can relax the physics. You can say, I don't believe that it's a lambda. Let me see what the data says. And you can move to a plot like a constant equation of state versus omega matter. And you can get different constraints. What will next generation constraints be from supernovae, from weak lensing power spectrum? And in particular, you can see now why it's so important to have multiple methods, because they're really nicely orthogonal to each other. The problem, though, is really there's a set of measure zero of fundamental physics theories that tell you there should be a constant W. And so if we just say, okay, I'm not going to assume it's constant W. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Let me just allow the possibility that it isn't. Your error constraints blow up enormously. So all I've done here is allow the possibility that there's not a constant W. So the red constraint blows up, the blue constraint blows up, and even the junction of the two blows up. So I've enlarged my physics. I've said, let me look more at the physics, and I've run into problems. The answer is add more data. So there are other types of weak lensing data we could add in. And there we pretty much we go back to the tight constraints. But we've now allowed dynamics. We've made it more realistic physics. If we want to pinpoint the physics and we look at that W naught W prime, here written as WA constraint, then suppose we combine supernova and CMB. How well can we constrain that running, that W prime? It looks like you do pretty good, But again, let's enlarge the physics. Let's allow for our ignorance. The simplest possible model is a flat universe with a cosmological constant. Let me break that. Can I see the difference between a non-flat universe that's a cosmological constant and a flat universe that's not a cosmological constant? Or heavens forfend, both broken at once, where it's where you have curvature and you have something that's other than lambda. If you do that, that's what you get. You blow up that nice little contour into this huge monster contour. All I've done here is not assume a flat universe. The solution, again, you add data in. So supernova plus weak lensing, I restore a nice tight contour, allowing for curvature. And so what I think we want to do in the next generation is we want to keep testing the physics. And to do that, we need that very precise data. We need to get the systematics down, as Ariel emphasized. And we need to continually enlarge our horizon. We need to continually test the physics. So we go from omega lambda, omega matter. We say, let's test, is it really lambda? And look at a W omega matter. And we got to say, well, it's not a constant W. That doesn't make sense. Let's test the dynamics. Let's look at W naught versus omega matter. Let's look at W naught versus WA, WW prime. Let's test the geometry. Let's say maybe curvature is not zero. Let's let the data tell us if it's zero or not. And then we say maybe it's not general relativity. Let's test the gravity theory. And so I think this sort of ladder of physics and data walking hand in hand is what we really want for the next generation. And as these contours show, if we actually can get data of this quality, we actually can learn physics this very stringent level.
Sorry, quick question. All these contours are one sigma level, right? And obtained from a Fischer matrix, right?
All these contours are, number one, include systematics. So almost every contour you see in the literature is purely statistical. These include systematics at the level we know. These are 68%, so these are one sigma joint contours, yes. And these are Fischer matrix contours, yes. The reality could indeed be worse, yes. Reality can always be worse. So this sort of progression of testing the physics, testing our framework step by step, is something I think we really want to do if we really want to understand what the physics is. And to do that, we're going to need the quality of data that we've been talking about here from a next generation satellite probes. And I'll stop there.
Well, I'm going to make a comment. This is a conversation Eric and I have had before, that there's complementary information you can get out of the data. Instead of going after a W and a W prime, you can go directly after the equation of state as a function of redshift. And if you do that, that's actually taking one less derivative of the data. So if you want to look for time dependence, this is a good thing to look for. Now, you have to, in the end, go for both the rho of Z and the W if you really want to learn about the pressure and the energy density both. So it's a complementary thing, but it's something that is very valuable to do with the data. So I just want to make that comment.
Thanks. I just wanted to make a couple of comments about, it's really your introductory material, I guess. And one of the things you said right at the start was that it was difficult to reconstruct the potential, even if you assume that it's a quintessence model. Then, as I think you know, there's a one to, as long as the equation of state is minus one or bigger, there's a one-to-one correspondence between potentials and W as a function of redshift. So therefore, by definition, if you can't reconstruct the scalar field potential, you also can't find that W is different from the cosmological constant case. Do you agree?
So I agree very much that you cannot reconstruct the entire function W of Z. And so that's what I was saying at the beginning. You can only sort of get two pieces of information out about it. And it's certainly true as you get closer and closer to minus one, it gets harder and harder to reconstruct the potential in any way, because your field is really just not rolled very much at all. So I'm not sure that's the same thing that you were saying.
Well, I agree there's that regime where the field hardly rolls at all, but that's the regime where you will also not learn anything from an equation of state approach. You know, if you cannot learn something about scalar field rolling in that part of parameter space, you also cannot learn anything about the equation of state being different from minus one. Because there's a one-to-one mapping between the two descriptions.
Well, it depends, you know, how much you want to learn, right? So, you know, if you're satisfied with WW prime, if you're satisfied with VV prime, then you're learning something, but you're not reconstructing in any you know, normal way. Right. So you can learn a little.
Yeah, I would say you learn an equivalent amount. I mean, my second point, I can't decide whether you're being pessimistic or optimistic about the two parameters. You're really stressing the two parameters. Now, you did the PCA analysis, and what you find is that you have two components that are determined quite a lot better than 10%, and three components that are determined quite a bit worse than 10%. But the actual parameters you're fitting aren't those components. They are some linear combinations of those components. So you have not supplied enough information for us to be able to tell whether or not even the two parameters you've got will both be determined at better than 10% accuracy, because they might pick up significant errors from having a large part of the less well-determined PCA components. On the other hand, the PCA components are significantly better than just two 10% determinations. And so some parameterizations, you might well be able to get a third piece of information to quite high precision. I guess that's a comment again rather than a question.
Right. So in the article, we try a number of different actual parameterizations, so not the PCA, and all of those we can only get two on. That's only saying maybe we weren't clever enough to find the optimal combination of PCAs that got us a third component. And that's something that does need to be addressed more.
About actually an interesting area about trying to target experiments specifically so that the PCA components of the experiment map well onto the fundamental parameters that you want to determine. It's kind of an issue of experimental design, if you like, because you have some ability to select your PCA components through experimental configuration so that they best represent the things you actually want to measure.
Well, Eric, you've done a lot of interesting work in the last year, particularly, and I wanted to thank you for a great talk.